pay your rent when the rent's due. I hope you got the diamond necklace that I sent to you. Cause when I was low, you was there for me. You never left me.
Our membership director maintains relationships with KABU members and listeners, create a process to meet or exceed fundraising goals, and manage the membership database. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kabu.fm/employment. Apply by March 15th. KABU is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland. Now stay tuned for Fortress on a Hill.
Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to America.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that.
You good people.
Welcome everyone to Fortress on a Hill. We have a really great special episode for you guys today. Danny and I are going to talk about his new book, Patriotic Descent. It's coming out on September the 8th. Is that right, Danny?
That's right. Yep, the 8th.
Coming out on the 8th. It's an amazing book. It's the history and the examination of patriotism that I've read about so far has been really empowering and eye-opening in a few different ways. But before we start talking about it real quick, I wanted to real quickly share with you guys our email and social media channel links. They're usually in the show notes, so if you ever want to find them, they're there, but I don't say it on the podcast very often, so I want to take 30 seconds and do that real quick. Our email is fortressonahill@gmail.com, and you can email any questions, any thoughts you have, ideas for episodes, anything like that. On Twitter, you can find us at Fortress on a Hill. Same deal with Twitter. And at Facebook, at Fortress on a Hill. So, real simple. It's all Fortress on a Hill. So Danny, let's start talking about this book. I'm really enjoying reading it. You know, I always learn so much from your writing, period. But this fit into a different vantage for me. Something that I think we should talk about at some time, but we don't need to discuss today, is I've noticed more and more as we've done the podcast that you and I were in very different wars, if we'll say. You know, that the stories that you told me, the missions that you've been sent on, the amount of death that you saw both among your troops and among innocent civilians during your time has been really eye-opening for me. But I've started to look at your writing in that way and asking myself about the things that I didn't experience, because you know, so much of the military is tied up in combat support, which means that if you're not an infantryman, a cav scout, a tanker, there are things that you just don't see. You know, there are just events and missions and possibilities of war that you just don't consider. And so moving forward, I hope that you and I get the chance to talk about that at some time. But I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute. Will you tell the folks what the book is about and how you got around to writing it?
Yeah, well, first thing I'm really glad you brought up is this idea of different wars. There's a couple of things that I think are important about that. So even within the same unit, as I've written about a bunch, even in the first book, people will like experience the same events differently. So there's that, right? There's the psychological aspect of the confusion of war and various viewpoints. And then, you know, there's the different kinds of jobs, and most people don't realize, you know, the tooth to tail ratio. In other words, how many combat sport, combat service sport soldiers there are for every, you know, combat arms, right? So basically foot soldier, like how many, it's, you know, it's what is 7, 8, 9 to 1, and it changes over the years. So, you know, back in the day, like in the Civil War, it was like 1 to 1, and then in World War II, it's like 3 to 1, and then in Vietnam, and now it like really pushes up to like closer to 10 to 1. That does not mean those people aren't in combat. At one point, I mean, it did, like in World War II more, but now with an insurgency and attacks on the roads and IEDs, you know, there was a point, I remember, that you may know some of this, that Henry, where early in the insurgency, because I was still a cadet at West Point, and the stat was presented to me by a major in military science class, and it showed that the top three MOSs, military occupational specialties jobs, right, that were fatalities or wounded in action in the first like 2 years of the Iraq War insurgency were, of course, you know, infantry, but it was military police and 88 Mike truck drivers, right? And this military science infantry officer was like, well, why would that be, guys, you know? And then, you know, we did some discussion on like tactics, and it was a pretty interesting day. But what his point was well, look, like if the classic tactic is IED, then who's on the road a lot, you know? And of course it's truck drivers. And then people don't realize like the extent to which I had a lot of respect for the military police in particular in Iraq, because they were just, you know, and I know that everyone did different things within the military police community, but the ones that I dealt with a lot, they literally drove around all day visiting police stations, like Iraqi police stations, and like trying to like mentor them and supply them and all this. And then, you know, they were just getting hammered because they were always on the road, you know. But it, but even so, that's a different war than, you know, like the active raid or whatever, you know. And then, like, quite frankly, I wasn't like some badass. I mean, the experience of the Navy SEAL raiding team is, you know, different from mine. And so I think that's valuable and interesting to keep in mind. And I think that what we do need to avoid, and I try really hard to, probably not perfectly, but better than most, is this idea that there, you know, okay, there's two wars, there's three wars, maybe there's more like 10 wars, but some veterans fall into this dismissing others kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Like someone will hear, oh, well, he was just a loggy or something, like, you know, and I don't mean like MP, I mean like legit, like a supply sergeant or something. It's like, oh, like that person's service doesn't matter. And, you know, I just think that's really dangerous talk. And I think it's usually bred by insecurity and self-righteousness, which I've always called like the cardinal or original sin of the soldier. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So that's a long intro that I just wanted to mention. But the book was weird. One thing that readers will notice is it's like very short for me, or for anyone, but especially for me. And that was by design. I had been in LA with Bob Scheer, senior editor over at Truth Dig. Rest in peace, pour some liquor out for our dead homies at Truth Dig, and now of Sheer Post. And of course, he's like kind of a legendary journalist, you know, 84 years old, like interviewed several presidents. So I was out there visiting him for some work at USC and some other crap. And yeah, me, him, and Steve Wasserman from Heyday Books were I don't even know how it came up. We were discussing like patriotism, or we were discussing the forever wars, or how to fight this, you know, how we can make a difference. And it was kind of one of those dark conversations. And Henry, you know these very well, because that's like how soldiers get by, is like macabre humor and stuff. But, you know, it was one of those really dark and serious conversations of futility, that feeling of the problem's just too big, like we can't change minds. I fall for that a lot, you know, especially with this stuff that's going on in the streets. I think to myself, like, oh my God, like, I can't persuade my father. Like, how am I going to persuade anyone else? And, you know, are people just too far apart? Are some people unreachable? These are dangerous concepts, although they're reasonable. I mean, there's a reason it feels that way, but we're having one of those conversations about ending the wars or reframing American foreign policy. And then, like I said on the Zoom talk the other night, you know, either Bob or I or both said something to the effect of, you know, if we don't conceptually change the entire notion of what it means to like be an American, and more specifically be an American patriot, like if we don't have a philosophical and cultural change, then like we're not, this is all for nil. And that drove one of us to throw sort of the, you know, the buzzword patriotic descent out there. The idea that if we don't challenge the very notion of patriotism, what value it has, if any, how it could be renegotiated, sort of reframed. And Steve Wasserman, who is an old friend of Bob, he's younger than Bob, he's the, you know, kind of the head of Heyday Books out of Berkeley. He said to me, he said, do you think you could write that up? And, you know, like the whole thing, like this new, like philosophical kind of take. And I said, yeah, of course I can do anything, you know? And he's like, all right, well, I want like a coffee table treatise on this, you know, like not some like huge book, you know, I want something that's different from what you would maybe normally do. And, more like an extended essay, I guess, than your typical book. And so that's what he asked for, and I had to write it really quick, actually, relatively, you know, for the publishing industry. And this is kind of how it came out, and it does read like an essay. So it's, you know, it's like three things that are going on, and then I'll kind of stop there. It's
you are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
It's only like 160 pages, but it's part memoir again, right? Just like the last book was, but this one's a little broader, whereas the last book was more focused on my time in Iraq. A little bit memoir, a lot of bit like philosophical take on what patriotism is, how it ought to be reframed, and why dissent can be the most patriotic of things. And then, of course, because it's me and it's important, it's, you know, history. So a history of dissenters, particularly military dissenters, throughout our history. I mean, I think I talk basically like War of 1812 or Civil War or Mexican-American War all the way up to Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, showing that there is a long history to this. So in other words, what I'm describing, what I'm calling for, in terms of a reformulation of the dissent as a form of patriotism, is actually has a long backstory, and that's kind of what I was getting at. And so here it is, and I'm cautiously optimistic that this one is gonna, you know, make some waves and get in some people's hands. So far, so good.
You mentioned Ghost Riders of Baghdad a little bit. I'm curious about not so much direct comparisons between the two books, but how would you say your personal opinions on patriotism and dissent changed between the time you wrote Ghost Riders and now Patriotic Dissent?
Yeah, that's a great question. No one's really asked me that yet. I've undergone, like most of us in this, you know, movement, so to speak, I've undergone like an intellectual and sort of ethical journey, an evolution, really. And so when I wrote Ghost Riders, which was in 2014, the end of my second year of grad school, I had only recently been back from Afghanistan. I knew a lot of stuff, but I wasn't like fully developed in my critique, like my systemic critique of the American militarist state. I mean, no doubt, like an average person would read that and be like, oh, this is like a radical, like kind of leftist dude. But those people who are like a little bit more in the know and kind of follow this stuff will recognize that at the time of Ghost Riders, I was like skeptical of like patriotism and like masculinity and stuff, but I wasn't talking about that a whole lot. I mean, I just didn't have the language or the expertise. I hadn't really thought through it quite enough yet. I was floundering a little, like just finding my voice, and I'd never written anything publicly. So this book definitely is a little bit more developed conceptually. So even though it's a shorter book, it's probably a little more clear in its like hypothesis, and I've thought through this more systemic critique of empire and the culture that's behind it, which is really what this book is about, right? It's about the problematic culture of patriotism, and it really does seek to answer the question, is patriotism toxic, as Bob Scheer says all the time. You know, he always asks me that question, and so I think it's an important question, like, is patriotism toxic? And I think that what I kind of come up with is like, yes, usually is basically my answer, you know, which is a bit of a hedge, but the idea being, you know, it would be, it's almost always toxic. It's almost always rooted in a history of sort of imperialism and patriarchy. It's almost always been a tool of oppression, both at home and overseas. It's almost always been a way to dupe folks into doing awful things, oftentimes that aren't in their own interest or the nation's or certain humanity's. However, right, I say there are variations on a spectrum of patriotism that are complicated, and that at the far end there has always been this tradition of sort of patriotic dissent, this idea that at its best, patriotism is the sense that I want my country to be what it is capable of, right? Live up to its aspirations, despite the fact that so many of our founding documents, which I talk about, are flawed and stuff. You know, it would not be fair not to admit that there has been beautiful stuff written by American theorists and politicians, that there have been even some of whom were like super hypocritical and all that, but there is something in the political tradition that comes out of the United States, especially in the late Enlightenment around the Revolution, that is valuable, and that should we live up to it, it could be worthwhile. And so real patriotic dissent then is not only a systemic critique of current policy, but it's a demand, a participatory, which, you know, I talk about in the book, the different types, but a participatory demand that the nation live up to its principles. And that's why I call patriotic dissent a, you know, participatory principled patriotism, right? And so, yeah, that's kind of what that was about. I could not have written that, right? I couldn't have like thought through and articulated that at the time I was writing Ghost Riders of Baghdad. I was still in the army. I was really in some like personal turmoil emotionally, I mean, and making my way in the world. I had no idea that I was going to be like a writer. I just wanted to tell this story. A lot of it was just vomit. Like I was just vomiting out what had been in my head for years. This was more thought through and organized, I guess.
So there's a couple of places in the book where you discuss some deeply personal anecdotes. To include being suicidal and dealing with the emotions / reality of the death and injuries of your own soldiers. I'm curious, not so much on an abstract level, but a more personal one. What discoveries did you make for yourself when you were writing this book? Because it's deeply personal.
You know, yeah, this was also a bit of therapy, but I wrote it at a little bit of a better place in my life. I had come out of a couple of hard years, you know, as you know, from the insider baseball, and I've had like a really good 8 or 9 months or so, you know, and kind of got my life together, whatever that means. You know, I understand it's halting, it could fall back again, but this book was, I was really plugging out the last bit of it just as I was kind of coming into a healthier place in my life that I'm living in now. And so there's a lot of sharing, there's a lot of kind of confession and admission of like past problems and tough times and phases that I've went through that, again, I'm not saying I'm out of, but it was more like reflective. I could look at it a little bit more objectively and say like, this is what I was feeling, this is where I was at, with the hindsight of a little bit of health in my personal life. So unlike Ghost Riders, which was completely just written in the breach, you know, of just turmoil and again still in the army and like not sure what all this is about and where my life's going to go, this one was a little more reflective. The experience of writing it is always tough. People used to ask me all the time, is it healthy for you, like is it a net positive for you to be a writer given what you write about, like is it good for your mental health? I used to get that question a lot, like early on when I would do like podcasts and stuff, and I would always say like yes and no, right? Yes, it gives me something to do. Yes, because I love it and I'm a dork and I want to read and write because it's like what I enjoy and it's also like what I can do, right? You know me and Mark's like to each according to his ability, you know, like that's my ability, right? Yeah. So that was always yes, but then the negative was always, but I mean, I make a living reliving the worst things in some cases, you know, when I write personal stuff, and then reliving it because usually I don't tell my own personal stories per se, but when you write about Yemeni kids starving to death as a matter of course, just like what I do, yeah, I mean that's a dark thing. So then I always felt like, am I like ever gonna be able to get out of the morass, you know what I mean, like am I gonna be stuck here mentally by virtue of the decisions I've made, like should I start writing, you know, kindergarten kids books? I used to think, now of course side note, those would be some dark kindergarten books, this would not be the BFG, you know what I mean, it would be like, you know, but anyway, but I used to say that like maybe a different job would be actually almost better. So I was always torn about it. Right now, and when I wrote the book, I think overall it was definitely more in the positive, like definitely more in the therapeutic and cathartic. It's kind of the culmination of a lot of ideas that I've been tossing around from, you know, 2000, from when I left West Point, so like 2017 till now. So it's really a summary in a sense of like the philosophical conclusions I'd come to during that really tough transition from, you know, fairly well-regarded military officer to civilian to kind of writer activist. So yeah, I think overall the experience was pretty positive. And one of the things that was interesting is more than even my normal writing, which I do tend to write fairly quickly, but this just like really flowed off the fingertips and off the head. Like I didn't have to do a whole lot of research. I mean there's a lot of research heavy history and stuff, but I'd already done most of that work, so I was able to just go back. What I mean is like the prose itself was like there. It's that I stayed up at night thinking about a year ago. I'm like, so it was like, in other words, all the data was there, and like Bob and Steve just kind of gave me the outlet and opportunity, and I'm really thankful to Heyday, who was super great, like to just let it go, you know, to like just let it out. And so the stuff was there, and it would have been kind of a waste if I didn't publish it, I think. And yeah, so that's what the experience was like. I hope that it was pretty positive, I would say. And I'm pretty happy with the output. I mean, no, I don't read the stuff that I write like ever again, usually. Like I never want to see it ever again. Like I hate it. Like I can't open Ghost Riders. I'm like, oh my God, did you really write like that? I'm like embarrassed of myself. I mean, even the technical writing, like I'm just like, oh my God, you were terrible. But this one, I mean, I didn't go back and like read the whole thing, but I've gone back and like looked at it to give like book talks and stuff. And more than usual, when I read it, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm pretty happy with this. Like I'm pretty happy with it, which is rare for me, you know?
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. Well, I'm really enlivened to hear that, Danny, that it's been such a great and cathartic experience for you being able to get those ideas out there. I'm curious, did you notice any role of heroism or the more black and white ideas played during the time of going the book? How did you see the notion of a hero doing it, maybe compared a little bit to Ghost Riders? And was there points where that concept started to buckle under examination?
Yeah, like what it means to be a hero and otherwise?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I think in Ghost Riders, I was still... Like, all of us are product, I think, of nature, nurture, the kind of culture we were raised in, and that's family, that's neighborhood, that's profession, it's class, and it's also America, right? It's just the end generation. So we're all a product of all those things, and I think that, like, the question for any human being is the extent to which finally, eventually, you can kind of transcend that. Right? Like, transcend the bias, identify it, and then say, no, I'm going to, like, take an empirical look at whatever this is and then come to a new decision about what's right. You know, most people never even try. Fewer than that ever get to even noticing the bias, you know, and then fewer still do anything about it and stuff like that. And I am somewhere on that spectrum and I'm not there yet. But I will say that at the time of Ghost Riders, I was definitely still romantically attached to the classic hero within the military. I mean, people who are conservative or more pro-war or even just more pro, like, military and, like, the current classic construct would not think that. They'd be like, are you kidding? Like, you totally lambasted the military and, like, every concept of patriotism and Ghost Riders. But I know, and you know, and people who kind of read this stuff a lot know, like, no, I was still there, you know? I mean, I think there was still, like, a romance to this sort of, like, sacrifice and war. I talk a lot about military service, and, like, when I go back and look at any of the essays and stuff that I wrote in that time where I talk about the draft and who served and who didn't, I sense in my writing a degree of, like, self-righteousness and also a little bit of, like, judgmental criticism of those who don't serve. One could read, and I didn't mean to do that, but I know I was, probably subconsciously, but also if you read some of the stuff even from, like, an intellectual standpoint, it's clear that I'm saying, look, it's better that the guys at Harvard served, right? Rather than just, you know, what I should just be saying is, like, it is better that there was more, you know, divided service, a little bit more fairly spread, and that there was the sense that everyone is equal and everyone has, like, an equal obligation and responsibility. But if you really read it, Ghost Rider, some of that stuff, it's clear that I've still got the sort of mythological military hero a little bit high up in my pantheon, despite the critique. That's never probably going to completely go away. I mean, I was raised in the martyrdom culture of, you know, Irish Catholic death cult. There's probably always going to be that aspect of, like, sort of the military sacrifice and heroics that are associated with it. What's different, I think, is that in the time between Ghost Riders and this book, and in terms of publication, we're talking about almost 5 full years. My heroes have legitimately changed. And, like, they are folks who had the courage to fight conventions and fight militarism, even at the expense of being called weak or being called soft or emasculine. And that's been a big change for me in my life. Is, you know, I would say back in the day that I supported all that, but in practice I was like, oh, but, you know, you don't want to look weak, like, you have to, you know, all that. And certainly if you look at the people that I choose to highlight in this book, they have changed since some of my early writing. And, like, my notion of heroism now, I'll just give you an example. Like, you know, I don't know if they'll listen to this, and, like, me and my father have, like, a very strained relationship, and it's a shame, and we disagree about why that is and a million things, but we do disagree a lot about politics over the years. And you know, I think, like, old Danny, okay, my dad was anti-war as a teenager, like, straight up, like, actively sort of opposed to the Vietnam War. Didn't want to, like, be in the, like, I'm not saying he would have, like, run away from it, but, like, didn't want to be in the army, didn't think it was right to, like, you know, fighting that war, that it wasn't worth it. He followed the path of more sort of the classic Reagan Democrat to Republican transition that so many baby boomers did, right? And he then got more and more and more like politically conservative and like pro-war and stuff. Well, 5 years ago, when we would argue about our positions on war, whether I said it, which I think a few times I terribly did, or thought it most of the time, there was a part of me that was feeling and probably communicating to him, and I think this kind of answers the question in a very indirect but important way, communicating to him, who are you to question my anti-war posture because I've been in two wars and you didn't want to be in them? And we're like, you didn't. That is intellectually and ethically paltry and it is satisfying in a like hit off the crack pipe sort of way. Do you know what I mean? Like an initial, but most things in our lives that feel that way, they're not so great. You know what I mean? There's something missing. Now, at the time of writing Patriotic Dissent, my position on like, for example, and I talk about my father, I'm not talking about just him, I'm talking about like a generational argument, like a classic case of like the pro and anti-war folks talking to each other. And there is an intergenerational aspect. And I bet that there are probably a million people who have this exact sort of relationship with like their father, uncle, insert whatever here. Now my position is this. I'm proud of my, what, no matter what he thinks today, right? And that's okay, and everyone's entitled to it. I am now, I am proud of my father's position as a 17-year-old because I, at 17, didn't feel that way about my wars of my generation. Like, his instinct, his gut was right. And so rather than, like, how toxic of me, right, to play the classic hero of, you don't get an opinion because you didn't serve in the war, so how dare you question me? That's just intellectually just terrible, logical fallacy. Now it's more like, okay, how can we have empathy? How can we reframe the entire concept of who gets an opinion? Who has value? What platform matters? What makes you a man? And so now I say, and like, I want to almost say to him, you know, like, and I haven't, you know, we've been really not speaking much, but like, I want to say to him, like, Dad, like, and I want to say to the whole people who went through his same development, Dad, like, I'm like super proud of that person. Like, I would have liked to have met that person. That doesn't mean that the person you are now is bad. It just means like, I'm sorry if I communicated that other way, because that is toxic. That's toxic masculinity, that's toxic militarism, and it's toxic patriotism. And this book is a rejection of that. And I'm not there, none of us are completely there, but I'm closer to saying the problem is the fact that we think having killed people or being in a position to want to or be willing to makes you not only tougher, better, but like more valuable, right, to society. And so the heroes I chose, even though many of them had been there, done that, and then had like a road to Damascus, they reject that. They reject the fetishization of that and the toxicity of that. So and that's a really strange answer maybe, but like I've never really talked about that before, and I think I'm on to something, or I hope, I don't know. Let the listeners decide.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. Well, a while ago, you were on, you had an interview on Eyes Left. It wasn't specifically about your book, but some of the subjects got covered there. And I really enjoyed, I'm gonna butcher it here, so I'm just paraphrasing, but I really enjoyed your discussion with them about how that we as veterans, as former, as people who went to war for America and came home, that we have a deep obligation to demystify the critiques of the military to such a degree that civilians, non-military folks like your dad can hold the same standing in an argument with a combat veteran because it's on the facts and it's not on the emotions. But I found that really powerful, and I know that I'm still making my way through that journey myself. You know, still have some of the same hero ideas that I did when I was in. They've changed and morphed a lot, and definitely lean much more towards anti-war these days. But I think that that's a really important thing, and I'm really glad that you brought that up and that you discuss it at length in the book, that civilians' role in this is very powerful, and we need, as veterans, need to make it powerful for them. And I think that's what we do here on the podcast.
Yeah, I totally think, you know, like, we're a veterans progressive podcast, so like, one could look at that and say like, you guys are selling based on the platform, right? Not selling like in a literal sense, but, you know, selling yourselves on the fact that you have this extra credibility. And I would say, like, guilty. Like, we live in the world as it is, and in the world as it is, we as a society has given veterans a platform. It has given us like a credibility with the public that we might not otherwise have. And so what I argued on Eyes Left, what I think I argue in the book, is that is a responsibility. Like, all applause, all laurels that are put upon you by a society are responsibilities, just like leadership. And most people don't look at it that way, but I think we really ought to. So if society, even if I don't agree that a veteran is just automatically better or more valuable in his opinions, or his opinions are more valuable, even if I don't agree with that, and I don't agree with that any longer, and I haven't for quite some time, but it was a slow process, society has said that I do, or that we do, and I'm not gonna. I have an obligation then. My obligation is to use it to those whom, you know, great things are given, right? You know, great responsibility. And then the second part is, as part of that platform, as part of that responsibility that has been kind of given to us by society, I think we have an obligation to say, no. Like, yes, I'm going to take it, but since you've given me this platform, I'm going to reject that. I'm going to reject the toxic sort of fetishizing of militarism that is inherent in that very sentiment that the veteran matters more. And so, in a sense, if we're doing our job, we make ourselves almost obsolete, right? And, like, that's okay. That's okay. I want people to listen to what I have to say because I read books and I think a lot. And I'm not saying that experience doesn't play into it. I think it should. I just don't think that our veteran experience, which, if you take sandpaper to it, it's very powerful to me to get to the root of all things. Like, what is this for? Like, look at anything. What is it for? If you scrub away the bullshit, the veneer, the pomp, right? What is there? Well, it's a willingness to kill and die, right? For an abstraction, almost always, right? It's never your home in American history, or even in most countries. It is rarely your home you're fighting for. So you fight for an abstraction, whether that be the state or the ideology of said state or the economic interest therein. You're fighting for an abstraction, your willingness to kill and die. I'm just not sure. Well, I am sure. Front-loading that, prioritizing that, that the opinions of folks who were willing to do that, I don't know. I think that that is very dangerous. And so, yeah, we have an obligation to sort of try to make that obsolete. And if it means we don't get invited to as many podcasts, well, then good. Because if it was easy and if it benefited us, then, like, it's probably not as profound an argument, right? If the argument you're making benefits you, even if that's not the reason you're making it, there's always going to be A, the suspicion that it is, and B, like, it's just not as powerful, right? Because there's no sacrifice inherent. And there I go with, like, you know, obviously the Catholic martyrdom thing, but I think that it's valuable. And so, yeah, that's what I talk about in terms of, look, I'm going to tell you the stories of these military dissenters, but my point is that we need to rise above that. And, like, salvation's not going to come from your veterans.
No.
If we can be a catalyst, if we can be a, you know, vanguard, to not go full-throated Bolshevism, but if we can be kind of like a vanguard, then, like, that's great. But this needs to be, like, a society rising and rejecting the current formation of patriotism, not the military grabbing everyone's hand and, like, you know, white savior, which literally, given the demographics of the combat forces, would be the case. Like, white savior military, like, sorry, that's not a good idea. That's not what should happen. white male savior at that.
Yeah. Well, Danny, I think that's a great place to wrap it up for today. I'm really excited for the book to come out. I'm hoping that listeners, I'm hoping you guys all go out and pick it up. It's going to be out on September 8th. Danny, can you tell the listeners where they can purchase your book?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for doing this, by the way, Henry. It's interesting. I really thought through some stuff in the interview here that I hadn't before. But the book, look, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Target. You can get it on Walmart. Don't do that. Don't do that. Go to Heyday Books, right? H-E-Y-D-A-Y. Heyday Books. Go to their website, Google it, type Patriotic Descent. Book is there with all the reviews. There's a pre-order link, and then once it comes out, there's an order link. You know, support publishers and the book industry. That's the best place to find it. If you go to my website, the link of the picture of my book will take you right there. Okay, but you could also just Google it. So do that, and I'm always flattered if people want to read the book, and I appreciate it.
All right, that sounds good. Well, folks, thank you for joining us today, and we'll be back again soon. Take care. We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, facebook.com/FortressOnAHill, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, and now KBOO.FM. You name it, just about anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
Thank you. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello. 1, 2, 3.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
Hey, Bluegrass lovers! Tune in Saturday, March 13th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. for a very special quarantine version of the Bluegrass Marathon from your friends at Music from the True Vine.
This year's marathon will feature homespun, socially distanced recordings from Jack Straw,
Left Coast Country,
John Cale and Annie Staninitz,
Caleb Clowder and Reed Wilms,
Doug Sammons and Jeff Smith,
Farmstrong,
and many, many more.
Don't miss this unique radio event to catch up with your friends and neighbors, playing music, and sharing stories from the lockdown.
Again, tune in to KBOO Saturday, March 13th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. for the Bluegrass Marathon.
Don't miss it.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor It Did Happen Here, the podcast producers, Thursday, March 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. This Zoom conversation is hosted by the Multnomah County Library. You can sign up for the event at the Multnomah County Library website under the events calendar for Thursday, March 11th. Selena Flores, Mike Crenshaw, and Aaron Yankee, producers of the podcast about fighting neo-Nazis in Portland, will answer questions about the process of making the podcast and the story and storytelling aspects. Again, that's It Did Happen Here, the podcast producers on Zoom. Registration happens on the Multnomah County Library website on their events calendar for Thursday, March 11th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
Hello, my friends. This is Life During Wartime.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, March 17th at 10 p.m. for Life During Wartime.
Not just a regular Life During Wartime, playing punk and hardcore, having live bands and letting you know all the underground DIY punk happenings going on in the Portland metro area.
Just because we're different, they have a spaz attack.
This is a celebration marathon. It's from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. It's our 26th year on the air, so we're having a 25th anniversary celebration.
Looking back at the DJs and bands
this is Life During Wartime
that have made Life During Wartime a punk institution in Portland, at KBOO, and on the World Wide Web.
Celebrate 25 years of Life During Wartime by donating during our anniversary marathon celebration.
On Wednesday, March 17th, from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m.
Here on your community radio station.
KBOO Portland.
are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.